In the matter of Meisels versus Fox Rothschild, may we please have appearances? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Devine, please go ahead. Come to the center. Thank you.
In this case, Your Honor, I represent the appellants, and the court granted cert to a cross appeal by Mr. Condon's client. So I suspected the court would want me to argue my issue first and then have Mr. Condon rebut and present his argument, and I rebut his argument. Is that how the court would like to proceed?
Why don't you try to address both arguments in your principal argument. If you'd like to reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal now, you can do so. But bring it all together for us.
All right. I will, Your Honor. Thank you, Justice.
You'd like to reserve a little, I guess?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, Justice.
You may do it a little less, but we'll have you back up. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My clients have appealed the appellate division's reinstatement of Mr. Meisels' claim for conversion because it rejects prior precedents in the New Jersey Supreme Court, misapplies the prior precedents of its own, and finds to be a conversion activities that do not qualify and are not considered conversions under existing New Jersey precedents. For purposes of this argument, Mr. Meisels deposited by wire transfer $2.5 million into my client's trust account. He did that to consummate his partnership agreement with Eli Weinstein and Mr. Weinstein's company, Pine Projects, for an investment in a project known as Berkeley Terrace. He claims that my client converted his funds by following the instructions of his partner, Eli Weinstein, and my client's client, Eli Weinstein, in dispersing funds that Mr. Meisels deposited to two real estate financing institutions, to Pine Projects itself, and to my client for prior bills that were outstanding in the amount of $75,000. He claims that my client's conversion cost him damages of $2.5 million. 2 years after filing this complaint, Mr. Meisels testified under oath that he received back his $2.5 million investment, plus $1 million in profit that Mr. Weinstein had promised and that Mr. Meisels had expected. And that's at pages 138A to 148A of the appendix. Mr. Meisels further testified that he took that $3.5 million that he derived from his investment in Berkeley Terrace and reinvested it 2 months after depositing the $2.5 million with Fox Rothschild. He reinvested in a second real estate partnership with Mr. Weinstein, $3.5 million in a project called Riverside Walk in Miami, Florida. Mr. Meisels filed his complaint in this matter 5.5 years after he made his wire transfer to my client's trust account, and 5 years and 4 months after he received back the $3.5 million that he invested in Berkeley Place. Now, Your Honors, I have to point out that the plaintiff's complaint does not contend, either in original or amended complaint, that my client received the wire confirmations of the wire transfers from Cambridge Mercantile. In fact, the Cambridge Mercantile wire transfers themselves demonstrate vividly that Cambridge confirmed those wire transfers by fax to Mr. Weinstein, to Pine Projects, to Right Match, attention, Mr. Meisels. So all of those people received notice of the wire transfers. My client never received notice of those transfers. Although the briefs and the arguments that Mr. Condon may suggest here today imply that my client received those wire confirmations, there is nothing in the record that shows that it did and it did not. Until my client received service of the complaint. The trial court and the appellate division both recognized that Mr. Meisels was unknown to my client, and my clients had no idea that Mr. Meisels even existed. Now, although this was not the first time Mr. Meisels has wired transferred funds into a lawyer's trust account, when he wired transferred funds into his personal lawyer's account, Ben Hager, he was very careful to provide specific instructions to Mr. Hager that the funds were not to be dispersed or used unless Mr. Hager received specific instructions from Mr. Meisels directing where the money should go. In the wire transfer that came from Cambridge to my client, there were no limiting instructions, no conditions, and no restrictions whatsoever placed on the wire transfer funds that were to be used for Mr. Meisels' partnership with Mr. Weinstein in Berkeley Terrace. The plaintiff, of course, justices, you know, bears the burden of proof to prove every element of conversion and to establish a record that can withstand summary judgment. On this undisputed record, Fox Rothschild did not convert Mr. Meisels' funds. As this court is aware from its off-cited 1951 decision in Mueller, one of three circumstances must exist for there to be a conversion. First, there must be change or destruction of the underlying chattel. Secondly, or the disjunctive, there must be a repudiation by the alleged converter of the owner's rights to the chattel. Or, three, there must be an independent exercise of dominion and control by the alleged converter that is inconsistent with the owner's rights in the chattel. None of those occurred in this case. Firstly, justices, Fox Rothschild did not destroy or diminish Mr. Meisels' 2.5 investment. He testified that he got it back 2 months after he made the investment. Money is money. Money is fungible. The value of the money was not diminished. Secondly, Fox Rothschild never repudiated any claim that Mr. Meisels had to his funds because we never knew Mr. Meisels existed. We never received any demand, any notice, or any identification of Mr. Meisels or his entitlement to the money. Thirdly, Fox did not exercise any independent dominion or control over the funds for three very distinct reasons. One, Mr. Meisels deposited the money for the specific use of Berkeley Terrace. He wanted his money in the account so it could be invested in the works and efforts of Berkeley Terrace. That's the use to which it was made. Secondly, Fox didn't repudiate anything because it never knew that Mr. Meisels existed, never received notice or identification of Mr. Meisels, so it couldn't possibly have repudiated his ownership rights. Thirdly, it did not exercise dominion or control over the monies because that is the way Mr. Meisels wanted his money to work. The rules of professional conduct, Rule 1.15B, specifically provide that when a client is entitled to property, the lawyer who possesses the property should provide it to the client promptly upon request.
Well, on the futility issue, you say money is fungible, and that is true enough, but we're talking about trust account funds, and there is, obviously, you point out the distinction between the depositor and the plaintiff. Your firm was not in a position to release those trust account funds to Mr. Meisels absent a whole lot of proof, correct?
To Mr. Meisels. When the money comes into the trust account, Your Honor, the lawyer has an obligation to release the money upon request of the client.
Right.
Mr. Meisels is not a client.
Right.
Of Fox Rothschild.
So you would not have, consistent with your ethical obligations in terms of the trust account, have been in a position to release that money to him.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't that help his case on futility?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. Futility goes to a destruction or diminishment of the value of the property.
Well, futility goes to, even if I demanded, nothing would have happened.
No, Your Honor, something could have happened. A lawyer holding money in trust is entitled to a demand so it knows that there's somebody else out there who claims the money. The futility aspect comes in. If we had received a demand or notice, there were several things we could have done. We could have sat down with Mr. Meisels and we could have reached some kind of agreement to pursue Mr. Weinstein together, to subrogate somehow to Mr. Meisels' loss, to do an investigation, to hire a lawyer to bring an action against Mr. Weinstein. Any number of things could have been done, Your Honor. It can't be said that the exercise of his demanding return of the money was futile when there were many other steps that we could take. The cases that you have authored demonstrate that alleged converters are entitled to make conditioned responses to demands after the chattels have been
Can I ask you a question,
moved.
Counsel? When we're considering the tort of conversion, and I'm informed a bit here by going back and looking at the restatement, it seems to me all the different iterations seem to assume that if the possession is lawful, and here the attorney trust account possession it was lawful, absent a demand, there can be no tort of conversion because it's the acting inconsistent with the demand that makes the possessor's subsequent actions tortious. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, Your Honor, but there are three disjunctive tests to a conversion. I would say, Your Honor, that if there is a demand, that is evidence of somebody's interest in the property, and we would have to, a converter would have to repudiate that demand.
Right, but I'm asking you this question because of the Appellate Division's focus on the need for or not for a demand. And if the possession is lawful, and I find it hard to dispute that the Fox Rothschild's possession here was lawful, they were holding the money properly in their trust account, it was not theirs that they exercised dominion and control over. It was the client's funds, correct?
You couldn't be more right, Your Honor.
Well, in that circumstance, doesn't there have to be, isn't demand essential in order to prove the elements of conversion, in order to show that this action was tortious?
Your Honor, I would say yes, unless there was a destruction of the
Okay,
but
we're not dealing with that here, are we?
No, we're not, Your Honor. You're exactly correct.
Okay.
Yes. My understanding of the law on my application is a demand was necessary. The court went off in a different direction and said demand would be futile, and with that I disagree. Money is money. Money is fungible.
Right.
Money comes in all types and varieties, and
that's
a demand
exactly right.
would have put us on notice that there was somebody out there. Now, the only way I maintain, Your Honor, that a lawyer who has possession of funds in a trust account, when it follows the direction of its client, could possibly have converted funds is if at the time it made the disbursement, it knew of a competing claim to the money.
Right.
And that's not the case we have in front of us.
As your restatement of the facts illustrates.
So what was Fox representing Weinstein on with respect to all that money that was in Fox's trust account?
Weinstein was a client of Fox Rothschild, Your Honor. There are other projects that Fox Rothschild did. There are 343A and sequentially in the appendix. But Fox had represented Mr. Weinstein in a series of real estate partnerships. In those partnerships, often the investors would transfer the money into Fox's trust account for the use of whatever it was. In this case, Mr. Meisel transferred it in to consummate his partnership agreement with Mr. Weinstein for buying and purchasing and developing a property called Berkeley Terrace.
Is that the property that was supposed to be developed in Irvington, or is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because that's what plaintiff is saying.
Yes.
That it put money in the trust account in order to advance this development project in Irvington.
Exactly right, Your Honor.
So when the money is dispersed to Pine Projects, North Star Realty, Eastern Parkway Realty, where was that money going to? Did Fox know that that money was going to advance the project for Berkeley Terrace, for this project in Irvington?
I don't know that it knew particularly. There's nothing in record that it knew particularly about this project, but in prior projects it had dealt with those entities. And if you look at the agreement that Mr. Meisel signed with Mr. Weinstein, the parties were to take out $6 million worth of loans. North Star and I forget the name of the other entity, Your Honor, are real estate financing entities.
So let me tell you the reason why I'm asking
Please.
This question, because I'm trying to understand the facts. I think I understand the law.
I'm trying to understand when money is going into a trust account, let's say for a particular development project. Here, Berkeley Terrace, we're building in Irvington. If the attorney who is responsible for representing the client then sees the money going out for what seems to be a project unrelated to that, does that create any sort of concern for the attorney, if that's the case?
Not on the facts of this case, Your Honor, because Mr. Weinstein had other relationships with these same lending institutions, and one of the distributions, Your Honor, was made to Pine Projects, which was, although the agreement says the partnership was with Eli Weinstein, the partnership was clearly with Eli Weinstein and his company,
okay,
Pine Projects.
Okay, so what you're telling us is that the partner at Fox had no reason to have any sort of suspicion that anything was amiss when the monies were released to Pine Projects, North Star Realty, Eastern Parkway.
Of course not, Your Honor. And he got Mr. Weinstein, the complaint says this, Mr. Weinstein told Mr. Meisels to deposit the money with Fox Rothschild's account. Mr. Weinstein directed Fox Rothschild where to distribute the money. Mr. Weinstein is Fox Rothschild's client. Rule 115 demands that Fox Rothschild disperse the money as its client directed. That's what Fox Rothschild did in this case, Your Honor.
You've represented to us and cited to the record that the $2.5 million investment for the property in Irvington, that money has been returned. Is there a dispute currently among the parties as to that?
I don't know, Your Honor, but there shouldn't be because Mr. Meisels testified to it at his deposition, at two different depositions, and I cited the court to that record, pages 138A to 148A of the record.
Then why are we here? This is a mystery to me.
What's the conversion, Your Honor? I don't understand either.
You're saying not only was there a conversion, but you're saying that the plaintiff made a profit.
Yes, sir. I'm saying not only was there no conversion, but the plaintiff got his money back and made a profit.
An important no.
Yeah, to me it is, Your Honor. Now, I suspect, Your Honors, that Mr. Condon may present to you a complaint that was filed by a gentleman named Burish Berger in federal court in Philadelphia in March of 2007. And I suspect that he may say that the allegations that were presented by Mr. Berger in that complaint gave rise, somehow created a duty on behalf of Fox Rothschild to make an investigation of any monies that were wired into trust accounts for Mr. Weinstein. There's some things that you should know about that. First, before Mr. Meisels invested a dime with Mr. Weinstein, Mr. Weinstein personally, face-to-face, told Mr. Meisels about the Berger lawsuit. Secondly, indeed, Mr. Weinstein asked for Mr. Meisels' help in having him transfer the Berger complaint from federal court in Philadelphia to a Jewish dispute resolution mechanism in the UK. Thirdly, Mr. Meisels helped in that effort, albeit unsuccessfully. He offered his assistance. And that, again, is in pages 138 and 139A of the appendix. So despite Mr. Meisels' knowledge of that lawsuit, it didn't concern him in the slightest. He knew about it. He could have asked Mr. Weinstein any questions he might. And it didn't deter him from making the investment in Berkeley Terrace that he made. A matter of fact, the record will also show, at pages 60 to 136A, that in the next 5 months, from May of 2007 to October of 2007, Mr. Meisels entered seven different real estate partnership agreements with Mr. Weinstein and invested over $30 million with Mr. Weinstein.
So these are all strong arguments, but also fact-based ones. Is it appropriate for us to consider them in the analysis of the legal issue before the court?
I think it is. I think they're undisputed, Your Honor. Under the testimony, their admissions of Mr. Meisels.
They sound like arguments to be advanced in front of a jury, not at this level. That's what I'm asking.
Okay. I don't think so, Your Honor. But here's why I would wrap this up with respect.
Before you wrap, these are factual arguments you're making now. Were they presented to the court during the summary judgment?
Of course they were, Your
Honor.
And
the court was able to assess the fact-finding and make determinations as to whether there are material issues of fact present in order to decide summary judgment motion?
Yes, sir, and it's a page 54A of the appendix, if you care to look it up.
Your argument to us is there was no conversion here, and that's why the appellate division decision reinstating the conversion count was off.
Correct, Your Honor.
This is a question of timing, counsel. I thought that federal lawsuit was dismissed by summary judgment in Mr. Weinstein's favor. Is that, am I understanding the record correctly?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. There was a 2008 dismissal of an action against Mr. Weinstein.
Yes, there was, Your Honor. It was another action commenced to take its place.
Okay. Thank you.
So with respect to that Berger complaint, Your Honor, so I would say just a few things for you that are pertinent to the justice's questions. The Berger case, any argument that's founded on that sounds in negligence. The court should be aware that the trial court and the appellate division dismissed all claims of negligence in this case. Since at least 1967, in your case, McGlynn versus Schultz, the Supreme Court precedents, followed by the appellate division in Chicago Title, have announced without question that concepts of negligence have no place in assessment of a claim for conversion. So any argument based upon that, I suggest to you, is just off base. Finally, Your Honors, Rule 115, which I've stated before, requires a lawyer to transfer trust funds to its client upon demand, does not establish two classes of clients. It establishes one class of client. It doesn't say when a lawyer receives a request from a client who's never been sued before, that the client has the lawyer has an obligation to return the monies to him.
What is the lawyer's obligation in a real estate type practice? There are LLCs. There are all kinds of entities. They sometimes come and go with astonishing speed.
No question.
What is a lawyer's obligation when the client is an individual to investigate who owns the funds that are coming into its trust account? If any obligation.
In a real estate closing where there's an escrow situation,
right.
Your Honor.
Not leaving that aside. We're talking about money's coming in for an investment in real estate. There's no closing yet. And the money, the check comes from an entity that has never been heard of before.
I think Mueller sets out the standard, Your Honor, and I think it says Mueller and Dynasty, which is another case that this court decided, makes it clear that if a lawyer has trust funds in his account and is called upon by a client to release those monies, unless that lawyer has knowledge at the time it makes the transfer as the client requests of a competing claim, there is no conversion. There is no obligation to investigate unless you know that there is some competing claim that is out there. My clients never heard of Mr. Meisel, didn't know of him. The courts have concluded that they didn't know he existed, so on and so forth.
Let me give you a hypothetical to test the rule of law that you just announced. Assume that a client goes to an attorney and says that I'm going to be purchasing property and money will be coming into my trust account from various sources. All that occurs, and then the client requests that the money go to some other entity totally unrelated to the real estate development project that the attorney thought all this money was coming into the trust account. Under those circumstances, would the attorney have some sort of obligation to make inquiry?
Your Honor, I don't think the law requires that, and I don't think Rule 1.15B requires that. And here's why, Your Honor. 1.15B, as I said, does not develop two classes of clients, one class of client. It doesn't say for a client who has been sued before, or a client for whom you have suspicions, or a client that seems to be requesting transfer to a different entity than you thought, you have a duty to investigate to see if there is a competing claim before you disperse the money to the client. Rule 115 doesn't say that, Your Honor. And in the real estate example that you give, Her Honor understood, real estate transactions close very quickly. Berkeley Terrace closed in less than 2 months. A lawyer cannot be in a position of accepting wire transfers into his account and then conducting some type of investigation to see if there's a competing claim. I dare say, if Mr. Weinstein's request for the transfer of these monies hadn't been honored, and the Berkeley transaction fell through, Mr. Meisels would be here suing us today saying, you should have given that money to Weinstein when he requested the money, and because you didn't, Berkeley Terrace fell through, and I lost my money in Berkeley Terrace. And that's not what Rule 115 requires. Rule 115 identifies one class of clients, whether they've been sued before, you have suspicions about them, or they haven't been sued before and they're virgins on earth, you have to give them promptly the property or the funds to which they are entitled when they ask for them. And if the law, as Mr. Condon, I think, has argued before, is the law of New Jersey, every real estate agent, accountant, stockbroker, anybody who accepts money from a client who has converted the money and then distributes the money as the client directs has become responsible for the conversion of the client.
Lawyers unless the lawyer has reasonable suspicions that the money is being used for some unlawful purpose, no?
I would say, Your Honor,
would that trigger an obligation?
Again, the law, as I read it in New Jersey, Your Honor, is that the lawyer must know of a competing claim, but a competing claim to the same funds that he is about to distribute. If he doesn't know that, he can't have converted the funds when he makes the disbursement.
I'm not talking about converting. Under circumstances where the attorney would have reasonable suspicion that the money is being dispersed, perhaps for an unlawful purpose, would the attorney under those circumstances have an obligation to start making some reasonable inquiries?
We don't have to get to that point, Your Honor. That's not this case.
So I understand that. But under that hypothetical.
I would have to give that some more thought than I've been able to give it for this argument, Your Honor. But
would that create a duty on every attorney or trust account to check and do their own due diligence on every single transaction in addition to just holding the money on trust for the client?
Of course it would,
but
Your Honor.
Create an adverse situation between the client and the attorney when the attorney's following up on the client's trustworthiness?
Yes. And then, Your Honor, what's the lawyer supposed to do?
It exposes the lawyer to malpractice risk because the closing's tomorrow,
yes.
And the lawyer says, we're holding up on this because I've got to check into who all these entities are, and I
got to ask this person, I got to ask that person,
I got to send out an investigator to investigate.
And then eventually, Justice, what's the lawyer supposed to do? Decide credibility for himself? Take a chance on which one to believe? Disperse the money or not disperse the money? Have the money go to the wrong person? Have the deal fall through? Be sued for letting a deal fall through?
Should we be guided in response to your list of questions there by Gandhi, where the attorney should be considering whether the attorney had done anything to induce reliance by the attorney on some third party?
Yeah. Your Honor, you're talking about apparent authority, and it's very clear that for the cases that your court has decided, that Mr. Weinstein's suggesting that Fox represented Mr. Meisels is the same as if Mr. Condon tells Mr. Meisels today that I represent him.
Well, I'm trying to keep separate the conversion analysis from the fiduciary duty analysis. Conversion, to me, the demand is very important, but in the fiduciary duty analysis, where we're looking at obligations owed toward third parties, there's got to be some reasonable expectation of knowledge of that competing claim, as you mentioned, and perhaps also something that the attorney has done to induce reliance by a third party. I'm not suggesting whether that's factually present here or not, but it seems to be two parts. Am I correct?
I think you're correct, Your Honor. The case that comes most to my mind is the case that Justice Patterson and Justice Alvin sat on called, Banco Popular, I think was the name of the case.
That's the Gandhi case that I'm referring to.
The Gandhi case,
yes.
Okay, the Gandhi case.
That was before my time, possibly not before
Justice
Alvin's
time.
I think
Justice Rivera Soto may have written that.
Yes.
Yeah.
In that case, Your Honor, I think you clearly declared that the linchpin of any lawyer's obligation or duty to a non-client depends on an invitation to rely upon the lawyer.
Right.
There are no circumstances or facts presented in this case that can possibly suggest that Foss Rothschild induced Mr. Meisel or reached out to Mr. Meisel or invited Mr. Meisel in any way, shape, or form to rely upon it, because they never heard of him and they didn't know about him. And it's not a case where you author an offering circular or a stock prospectus that you know is going out to some class of people that you can reasonably expect to rely. This is a law firm that maintains a trust account.
In which the property belongs to the client.
Correct, Your Honor.
The known client.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I was going to invite you to speak to the cross petition. I think you have. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor, except it's very clear that the facts and all the precedents of the Supreme Court say there must be some invitation to the person for them to rely upon the law firm. There's simply no facts to support that whatsoever. So with that, Your Honor, you've listened to me very patiently. I'll reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal and allow Mr. Conton to talk to you.
Ms. Manning. We'll come to you after amicus.
Good morning. Thank you on behalf of the New Jersey State Bar Association for hearing our argument. I'm going to start where counsel left off. When a lawyer becomes admitted to the state of New Jersey, they agree to zealously advocate, be a zealous negotiator, be a zealous deal maker on behalf of their client. Now, this court has recognized that there may be duties to a non-client, but in the Banco Popular case and all of its progeny, you make clear that the linchpin to a claim by a non-client is the invitation to rely and reliance. So the lawyer must take some action on which the non-client is relying. Here we know factually that that's not the case. We know because Mr. Meisel admits he had no communication with Fox Rothschild. He didn't identify himself to Fox Rothschild, and he certainly didn't put any conditions or instructions or limitations on his wire to Fox Rothschild. So under that analysis, it's hard to see how there can be a breach of fiduciary duty to a party that you did not know existed, especially when this court has recognized that there's a tension between obligations to a client and obligations to a non-client. And here, to create any kind of obligation would amplify that tension, because you would be putting the lawyer in a position where they'd have to investigate their client. And I think, as counsel aptly noted, where does that go? How do you make a decision on that? So based on the facts of this case, we submit there can't be a breach of fiduciary duty. With regard to conversion, there's two critical elements here. Here, there was no demand for the funds, which is critically important. But the second aspect that is critically important is dominion and control. RPC 1.15 makes clear that funds held in trust or property held in trust is not the property of the lawyer. It is the property of the client. In fact, we know that the lawyer is not even entitled to pay his or her own fees out of funds held in trust, even if they're due and owing.
So are you saying, Ms. Manning, that there's no claim for conversion in any trust account setting?
I think it's certainly possible that there could be a claim if there was a demand that was ignored, mm-hmm. if you were aware of a competing claim and you made a distribution, or perhaps, and we got a little bit into that on the primary argument, if the client was using the attorney's services in the commission of a crime, in which case that's not allowed either, and you would look to competing RPCs. So the rules aren't a get-out-of-jail-free card. You're not allowed to commit a crime. But absent those circumstances, I think the RPCs make clear that you need to promptly disperse funds when your client requests it. And if you don't, you're subject to ethical complaints by your client. On TV, you know, lawyers are portrayed as magicians, as mind readers. Suddenly they pull a rabbit out of the hat. They have all the relevant facts. That's not true in real life. Lawyers can only discharge their obligations based on the facts as they know them at the time they're being asked to discharge those obligations. And to hold otherwise would open up lawyers to a panoply of malpractice claims and ethics violations. So we submit here, not only is there not a breach of fiduciary duty, but there certainly cannot be a conversion claim based on these facts.
Questions, anyone?
So stated differently a little bit on that last point, the bar's position is that the attorney's possession of the funds in their trust account is lawful.
Yes.
And in order for there to be, for example, the tort of conversion, there has to be one of those three things that renders their subsequent action with regard to that money tortious.
Exactly.
The demand, that's where demand is critical. It can't be ignored. Being aware of a competing claim and so forth.
And I
so,
think
so under your analysis, in this case, on the conversion claim, we don't even get beyond the exercise of dominion and control.
Absolutely not. It would be very similar to a bank. A bank is holding funds for a customer but doesn't control the direction of the funds.
Right.
Neither does the lawyer.
Right.
The lawyer doesn't have discretion if they're given a direction by their client of what to do with those funds.
So the analogy is as a custodian of monies or a bailee of chattel, and as long as the possession is lawful and they act in compliance with the known client's direction.
Exactly.
So I'm just going to give you one, and I'm not suggesting otherwise in terms of what the obligation of the attorney is, but the attorney is representing a client for the purchase of a house, and it's receiving money from the client's parents and maybe brother and sister. All the money goes in the trust account for the purchase of the house. The last moment, he tells the attorney, just cut me a check. I'm going to Atlantic City. Any obligation there?
Not under those factual circumstances, but I certainly think the parents, the relatives, the brothers and sisters can and could have an opportunity to protect themselves by saying to the attorney, we're giving you this money for the purchase of a house, and if that house is not going to be purchased, we expect it to be returned to
right.
us. Otherwise, the lawyer has to investigate what's the intent of all the parties. The money could have been a gift from the parents and the brother and sister. The money could have been deposited, and I think that that's an important point because in the current environment, money is coming in and being transferred in all different, you know, my kids are using Venmo. People want to transfer money through their credit card, through Apple Pay. The ability to kind of discern where the money comes from, absent the person who expects protection saying, we expect protection, can be virtually impossible in some circumstances.
Thank you, Ms. Manning.
Thank you.
Mr. Conta.
Good morning. If I may please the court, I'm just going to jump around a little bit in response to some of my colleagues' comments. First and foremost, as part of the record on 22A and 23A, is the wire confirmations that indicate that Wright Match and Cambridge wired the money into Fox Rothschild's escrow account. Nowhere in that piece of paper, those wire confirmations, does it indicate it's for the benefit of Elihu Weinstein or any of his companies. It's not there. So I would submit that money submitted in Fox Rothschild's account, if they don't know whose it is, it belongs to my client. As this court cited in Frost, which cited the Diletto case, an attorney cannot satisfy his or her professional responsibility with respect to escrow funds by simply relying on information from a client. Quote, it is not enough to follow a client's instructions. As Mr. Devine indicated in his brief, Fox Rothschild was told by Weinstein, hey, we're getting $2.5 million in your escrow account. That was it. And I'm sure Fox Rothschild, the respectable white shoe firm that they are, I'm sure gets lots of monies every day. I'm sure this was not the only $2.5 million in their account. I don't know if there's an indication of when that money was coming, for what purpose that money was coming. What is important, and I'm glad my colleague mentioned it, a gentleman from England named Mr. Berger wired $36.5 million to various entities, not escrow funds, not into the attorney account. And Fox Rothschild engaged with Mr. Berger and Mr. Weinstein. They had meetings in their New York offices, plenty of phone calls about these real estate deals that were allegedly going to happen using these $36.5 million. Well, Mr. Berger didn't get any confirmation of the deals and asked for confirmation, and Fox Rothschild said, you know what, the deal is done, we'll give you your money back. And this was the Eastern District case that is 07, it was 07 CV0994. That case was brought on the 13th of March, 2007, where an allegations were made, hey, I used all these monies and I sent them out of my account in England, which were held in escrow, to buy property that never happened. And Fox Rothschild's partner in that case was the same gentleman who authorized the release of these $2.5 million today. And when was that authorized release? Less than 2 months later. So there was a federal lawsuit that was brought that said, hey, I invested all this money and nothing happened. Fox Rothschild said, you know what, give me your wiring instructions and we'll wire your money back. Crickets. Never got any money. They had to go to federal court in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania to get their money back. And that lawsuit was filed 2 months before my client submitted 2.4 and change into Fox Rothschild's account. Now, this court had said in Frost, and I quote, it is well settled that is a matter of elementary law that when two parties to a transaction select the attorney of one of them to act as the depository of funds relevant to that transaction, the attorney that receives the deposit as agent for both parties. So, excuse me, when Mr. Weinstein told Fox Rothschild, hey, I'll be getting some money in my account, and Fox Rothschild knew that this was a developer, this was not their first rodeo, that was Fox Rothschild's getting tacit permission from Weinstein that to act as escrow agent. I would submit that when my client remitted the money into Fox Rothschild's account, that they tacitly admitted that they were acting as the agent for both Mr. Weinstein and my client.
Mr. Condon, I'm going to let you get a glass of water. I'll ask you a question while you're doing
sure.
So. You brought a claim for conversion. We heard from Mr. Devine that the $2.4, $2.5 million that is at the core of that count has already been returned, and he cited this in deposition testimony. Is that in dispute?
Your Honor, it is in dispute, and I would argue that the reason I know it's in dispute is because the appellate division in the lower court heard all of those facts, and we're here today on conversion and breach of fiduciary duty.
Why don't you tell us from the record what is disputed about that?
These gentlemen had a relationship that were fluid, that it was a lot of back and forth. This was not the only project that they had invested in. There were other projects that Fox Rothschild may or may not have been a part of. Mr. Weinstein was arrested very shortly after the monies that were submitted in escrow by my client to Fox Rothschild. I think it was 2007 when he was finally arrested.
Did your client answer under oath at a deposition that these monies had been returned to him?
Yes and no.
No. It's either yes or no.
Well, the record speaks for itself, but
I'm asking you the question. Your attorney record, you're familiar with the deposition. Did your client testify under oath at a deposition that the $2.5 million have been returned to him?
That's what the deposition transcript says.
No, that's what your client says. The deposition transcript just records it. Was that under oath at a deposition?
I'm assuming it was, Judge. I wasn't there, but of course it was under oath.
Then why are we here?
Because the appellate division found that the case of conversion should be heard for a jury. So the issue was not...
If your client received the money that he invested back, where is the loss?
Again, Judge, that is a disputed fact.
How is it disputed if your client, under oath, in a deposition, said he received $2.5 million back, the same monies that he had placed in the Fox Trust account?
I don't think that's what the testimony was, that he received the same monies that were going in. Again, this was fluid. Did he receive $2.5 million in other transactions? Yes. Whether or not it was earmarked for this case or for other monies, at the end of the day...
Did he lose the $2.5 million that he invested in this project. Did he lose not the dollar with that serial number, did he lose the $2.5 million that he invested in this project, or did he get a return of that $2.5 million plus some profit?
He lost it. Our contention is he lost it.
So he never got the $2.5 million back?
Not what was sent to Fox Rothschild, no.
I'm not asking you about whether the check came back or the dollar with the serial number came back. The $2.5 million, it's a very direct question, it's very simple. The $2.5 million that he invested in this real estate project, did he get $2.5 million back on this real estate project?
No. Okay. No. And to go back to the conversion case, if I may, before I lose the point, I'll certainly answer any questions. They talk about the Pine projects, that monies were sent on the Pine projects. Well, there was also $1 million, which is just shy of half the money that was deposited to an Eastern Parkway, $1 million, which has nothing to do with the Pine projects, and $75,000 went to Fox Rothschild.
Let me go back to your answer, Justice Solomon's question and the other questions. Is it your contention that money, the money that your client admitted getting, was somehow based on another transaction?
Correct.
You agree that Fox did not know of the existence of Mizell. Do you agree?
Other than the fact that Mr. Mizell's was on the wire confirmation, I don't agree with that. Mr. Mizell's was on the wire confirmation that was sent by Cambridge to Fox Rothschild's escrow.
Obviously, Mizell is a very sophisticated entrepreneur. Did he place any restrictions or conditions on the use of the money that he wired into Fox's trust account?
Not according to the wire confirmation, no. And I don't disagree that he did not have any communications with Fox Rothschild.
So step back from this case and tell us, if a client tells the law firm, you're going to get a check tomorrow into the trust account and I want it to be dispersed to A, B, C, and D, what is the attorney's obligation at that point? And what source do you have for whatever obligations you're about to suggest?
A client of a firm gets monies from the client.
No, the firm gets money.
Firm gets the monies.
What's the genesis of the monies? Where does it come from? Does it come from the client?
Client says you're going to get a check tomorrow.
And is that money coming from the client? Is it a client?
Answer it either way.
If it comes from the client, knowingly that it's coming from the client, then no. I don't expect that there has to be an obligation.
It comes from a third party.
Comes from a third party. And by the way, and I'm going to get back to a second, the monies were deposited on the 16th of May, 2007. They were wired out on the 17th of May, 2007, the next day. So to the extent that there's an obligation to inquire when you don't know where the $2.5 million comes from or what purpose, if Fox Rothschild knew it was for the Pine Projects job, why are they wiring $1 million? To Eastern Parkway. Why are they taking $75,000 of that money, which I would contend is also that of my client?
So tell us the principle that would apply in this and other cases. What does the firm have as an obligation once that money is received?
Well, first, not to take just the representations of its own client as to where the genesis of the money came from and what it's to be used for.
How is Fox supposed to know what your expectations are for the use of the money when you're just wiring it into a trust account and not giving any instructions, any conditions, any limitations?
Well, in a 9/11, a post-9/11 world, I don't believe anyone could wire anything. If this was overseas monies, too. So Fox Rothschild can receive monies from anybody overseas in England, and because their client says, send it here, they have no responsibility to find out the genesis of the funds.
He knows the genesis of the funds. It's been wired from you. The client tells the attorney that I'm going to be engaging in whatever it may be, and I'm getting money. And the money comes in, no restrictions, nothing. Like, what is the obligation of the attorney? Supposed to call up Mizell? Or if there are three different or four different sources, hey, how do you want me to use this money?
Well,
is that what you're claiming the obligation is of the attorney?
Well, respectfully, Judge, I would imagine probably maybe 90%, at least of my work, we have escrow agreements with both parties be it real estate, be it commercial transactions, because I...
That's different. You don't have an escrow agreement. Mizell did not create an escrow agreement with Fox, did it?
It's Fox Rothschild's obligation to create the... They're acting as escrow agent. Once that money comes into their account, the Frost case doesn't say that the attorney has to agree to accept that responsibility. Once they accept the monies, they're creating an agency relationship as the escrow agent.
What rule of professional conduct do you rely on for this position you're taking, that the attorney has a fiduciary duty to not just the client, but the person who wired the money? Can you cite me to a rule number?
Well, I think the position was asked earlier, if a client says, I want the money to go to Atlantic City,
but please, it's a real simple question. Try answering my question. Do you have a rule number for that proposition?
No, but this court can make one.
What inquiry, if there is an inquiry, what type of inquiry would the law firm have to conduct?
To reach out to the origin of the money and say, just confirming, you wired $2.5 million into my account. This money is to go to the use of Elie Wynow.
And until it gets an answer that is satisfactory in some manner, has to sit on the money, notwithstanding its client's request?
Well, it's a little unusual that the money was sent out of the account but less than 24 hours later. And again, the wiring...
That's unusual in a real estate setting? It's unusual to have money wired in the day before?
It's unusual for the wire confirmation to not state to whose benefit the wire is.
Okay, it's a different question, but you're talking about the timing being unusual. I don't know where you're getting that.
Well,
that happens all the time in real estate, doesn't it?
Well, a red flag should be raised when 30 days or 60 days earlier.
So the lawyer then has an obligation to find out about entities in London, find out who these people are, find out if they really like the client and want the client to have the use of the money, investigate the endless parade of evolving entities that exist in a lot of real estate investment settings. Where does this end? And by the way, the closing's canceled because the delay of this investigation goes forward.
I believe in today's day and age, I think there is an obligation, especially overseas money, for the receiver of the monies to ascertain where the monies came from.
There's federal statutes on that, but we're not talking about that. You're talking about the 9/11, post-9/11 statutes?
Correct.
Well, that has nothing to do with this case, does it?
Practically speaking, monies came over from England. You don't know where, for what purpose it came. There is no allegations by Fox Rothschild that they were told what the monies to be used
for. Why didn't your client place instructions with the wire transfer? I'm trying to figure that out. You represent a very sophisticated client, okay, forwarding a lot of money over to Fox Rothschild. It would seem very simple, a sentence or two indicating the use to which the money is to be put. Why didn't your client do that?
I can't speak to why the client didn't do that. I don't know why there wasn't an escrow agreement. I don't know why Burrish Berger sent $36.5 million. Mr. Weinstein must have been a very...
And now you want Fox to be a mind reader? Because your client didn't give Fox instructions?
I would like Fox to be have a fiduciary obligation to my client when they accepted monies from my client, which makes them an agent for both parties, not just Mr. Weinstein, but for my client as well. And to ask the law firm to do a little due diligence to find out the genesis of the money, I don't think is asking very much.
So your position is that the fact that there was an escrow confirmation that has the entities the money came from and apparently Mr. Mizell's name that went to Fox Rothschild, on that basis, they're now on notice that they are representing not just Mr. Weinstein, but Mr. Mizell's.
Well, there's no reference that this money belongs to Mr. Mizell's.
I just asked a simple question. Based on that confirmation, your position is that Fox Rothschild now represents Weinstein and Mizell's, has a fiduciary responsibility to both?
I do.
Okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Devine, brief rebuttal.
Your Honor, I will waive my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the fine presentations. We'll take the matter under advisement.